I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this. It is the third ever episode of our new podcast. Well, it's not new anymore, is it? Pilot episodes. And as always, I'm joined by Dunk, Godders, and, of course, Parky. How are we, chaps? Do it one at a time.
Which in one that order.
In the order that I read them out.
Tell us what to do, please. Hey, JB, it's Dunk. Good to be here.
Now, Dunk, did I see that you were flying the chipmunk this week?
Yes,
I've got a cheeky little photo of you on Twitter, looking like Skull Crusher, actually, with poor old Suggs, I think it was, getting out the back, looking massively dejected. What have you been up to?
Yes, I've had a wonderful time crushing skulls this week. It's been fantastic.
No,
I've got a little story about that.
I'm going to have to jump in here and say that voice you've just heard there is Godders.
Can you actually hear me this
Yeah,
week?
Yeah.
I've had a little bit of banter about that.
And you are quite quiet.
The only person we've not heard from yet, say hello, please, Parky.
Yeah, hi, JB. What I liked was Godders didn't even say his own name. He went straight
into
in
it.
For the kill with Mason.
He's so keen, it's ridiculous.
You can't mess around if you think you're dead.
All right, then. Right, Dunk, tell us about your chipmunk. Go.
Okay, so this week I've been at BBMF, which is it's great to go back there. It's great for me. It's not so great for them. So we've
miserable
been,
for them.
Miserable for them. But just having a look at their pilots, how they instruct, and also some of the guys that are either doing their first season, just looking at how they fly the chipmunk. So it's been great fun for me in the chippy, and I had the pleasure of flying with the newly selected officer commanding of the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. As God has said, there's a guy called Suggs. He's a great fella, and we were flying in the chipmunk, and he has to show me a number of events. Some of them different landings. One of them being a what we call a practice force landing, where we fail the engine and then glide the aeroplane back to the runway. And I said to him, right then, Suggs, we've been doing everything to the main runway. Coningsby's got a little grass runway as well. I said, so it's all going really nicely. Let's do a practice force landing to the grass. And he went, what? I said, well, let's do a practice force landing to the grass. He went, I haven't done one of those before. I said, so the poor bloke, like you said, I think the skull crusher side came out. I was like, well, it'll be all right. Come on, we'll give it a go. So we gave it a go, and he was absolutely fine. But I did think of you boys giving me the skull crusher banter, making him do an approach to a runway he'd not done before.
Now, how hard is a grass landing compared to something you'd usually do?
Well, I reckon that they certainly the Spitfire, you know, it prefers to be on the grass. The only drawback to it is that they can be bumpy. Obviously, you know, tarmac, generally it's all smooth and lovely and you know, you can grease them on, hopefully. But sometimes on the grass you get bumps and she gets airborne after you've landed, and it can all, you know, you can blame the grass, I guess, for a rubbish landing. But actually, when the tailwheel's down, they prefer being on grass. And they were designed for it, you know, back in the day it was all grass runways, a big field, look at the windsock and take off and land into wind.
The most scary one I landed on was, I'm back to being scared again, was White Waltham. That's a grass runway. way and a half, isn't it?
It's a bumpy one there.
Whenever I went, so my mum lives just down the road from White Waltham. So whenever we were landing there, my mum would come down. So, and I would always bounce the blooming thing off the bump in the runway. So my mum said to me, she said, "You're not very good at landing, dear, are you?"
Not to the only one, mate.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Tell me this then.
My first Hurricane trip went out on that BBC programme, The Flight. And I remember the first time I met Geoffrey Whelan, he'd seen it. And he went, "Parky, have you ever tried three-pointing?" And I thought, oh, God, kill me. Yeah, I just bumped it down the runway in front of the world. Horrid.
Tell me, are you using chipmunks because they are the closest thing that you can find to practicing landing a Spitfire, and they're fairly cheap?
Well, I think, you know, the chipmunk is a great trainer for the Spitfire. There's a number of reasons. The fact is, the Air Force has still got two chipmunks, so we don't have any other tail dragging aircraft apart from the fighters that we've got, so we're sort of limited. It might not be the best aeroplane to train for a Spitfire because, of course, it's pretty small. There's not much momentum. It doesn't have much power, so much torque with the engine. But in terms of putting someone that's not used to tail-dragging aircraft, it's great initially. And it does sort of almost have the nose authority of a Spitfire when you're coming into land. It kind of feels, you know, vaguely like you're going to feel in a Spitfire. So, you know, it's really got a lot of advantages to training in that.
It's a pretty safe aeroplane as well. I remember the first couple of times that I tried to land it, it was like a shopping trolley going sideways, but you could get away with a huge amount, which you can't in the big aeroplanes. I mean, it was a trainer, like Dunk said, for years and years. But just one of the best aeroplanes that you could ever fly. You know, you fly it with two fingers and it's an awful lot of stick and rudder. And when you get used to it, she's utterly brilliant. You know, I used to really enjoy flying with Duncan Parky, actually. Parky, do you remember? We were talking about the other day, I was up on BBMF, and they don't go to Wickenby anymore.
No.
But we used to have fantastic trips up there where we just simulate fail the engine on each other and just try and get into the runway, which will save your life if you're in one of those big aeroplanes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Chippy is such a brilliant little trainer, especially for the Spitfire, in terms of feel. And the horrid moment is when you get thrown in the back seat of the Chipmunk, so you have somebody huge like Dunk in front of you. So again, you're just simulating that poor view of the Spitfire. You know, it's got that great long nose and the Merlin. And you can't see. Once you're in the landing attitude, you physically cannot see ahead of you. It's all peripheral vision. And that's very unusual. You know, when you fly jets, you get great view. You know, you see the landing exactly where you're going to touch down, whereas in a tail dragger, it's completely different. And the Chippy is just a great trainer for that.
That's interesting you mentioned that. Is the field of vision you get out of these piston aircraft at the Battle of Britain, is it not particularly good?
Once you, you know, get airborne, so, you know, as you taxi out, it's horrendous. If, you know, if you sit in a Spitfire and you look ahead, you can see nothing in front of you. It's sitting on its tail, so you've just got this massive Merlin engine in front of you. But, you know, for takeoff, you can raise the tail on the Spit so quickly, you know, almost immediately as you power up it, it produces enough lift from the prop wash and you raise the tail. And then you've got a great view. It's like you're in a modern day aircraft with a nose wheel. So you've got a great view for takeoff, but it's the opposite when you land. It's, you know, as you slow down, the nose comes more and more up and the view disappears as you roll out on final. So yeah, definitely it is a skill set that you have to get used to. And the first time you do it, it is weird. You know, you are landing, not being able to look ahead.
That is absolutely incredible. I never actually thought of that. So how would you go about doing it? I mean, what kind of little tips or who are you relying on to bring you in?
I'm going to ask Mason because he's the instructor and standardizing it. Yeah, what are the best ways of doing it, Dunk?
You shouldn't have asked that question, JB. We're all going to have 17 different ways of doing this now.
Yeah, yeah. I think the fact is probably, you know, the main way is you kind of have to look through it all, or look through the nose almost, because you have to use your peripheral vision. It's no good looking just one side, though, because that becomes polarized. You kind of have to be taking in the whole view left and right and looking all the way to the horizon so that you can judge your height. So you can really use your peripheral vision to try and judge how high you are from the ground and judge the flare so it touches down nicely. And there's all, of course, as Parky was saying, there's all sorts of nuances to it. But I think that's probably the key, is just to try and ignore the fact that you've got a massive this massive nose in front of you and use your peripheral vision and look to the horizon.
And yeah, you're quite used to that, Doug.
No wonder you were good at it, Doug.
You were so good at it, I hadn't ever realised why. You only have peripheral vision in real life.
Oh, speak up. Hey, now, I was looking at I was sat in one of the offices today, and there's a picture of the Mark 19 Spitfire, and it was just the view of it was such that, so the Mark 19 had a Griffin engine in it, a 37 litre Griffin engine rather than the 27 litre Merlin, and it just meant that this aeroplane, this Mark 19, the nose was nearly 2 feet longer than the early Spits. And it's just huge. It must be nearly 9 foot long, the nose on this aeroplane. It is just massive.
Now, can I ask you...
That aeroplane was definitely like a rocket ship when you went flying it for the first time, especially compared to the other aeroplanes. But it's interesting, just to butt in a second there, JB, the Parky mentioned the three-pointer. So when you're in the chipmunk, it's quite easy to land... I say easy, the boys are smiling at me now, but quite easy to land all three wheels at the same time, which is the approved technique. But you've got, you know, you're essentially stalling the aeroplane onto the runway at that point. So, you know, you're losing all your lift. And I did find it definitely a couple of times in the early days, and it could happen to you in a, I found it in a Spit more than a Hurricane. I don't know what the boys think. But I used to call it the Wile E. Coyote, where you'd flare because you can't see out the front. You're kind of judging peripherally how high you are, and you're waiting for it to settle on the runway. And actually, you've tried to settle it a foot above the ground. And when it runs out of lift, you feel like Wile E. Coyote when he's run off the cliff, has that 1 second realization, then his body disappears, and then his neck lengthens, and then his head disappears as you hit the runway quite hard. So there's a real old skill to it. And actually, I don't know whether the guys still do it, but definitely in my time, I was the tail down wheeler. So landing on the main wheels, really, with the tail wheel just off the tarmac, and then letting the aeroplane run out of energy on her own, worked definitely a bit better for me.
That must be quite counterintuitive for you guys, because isn't like one of, as you can tell, I know nothing about flying, but isn't one of the key things about flying not stalling?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you fly, you don't want to fly an aircraft too slow. So, you know, all aircraft will land above their stall speed, but, you know, you're not far off it. And, you know, it's a... it's just that judgment call. It is weird. I can remember now just some of the reports written, and for some reason that Wiley really caught on. And if you had a final little sort of plop down at the end, it was almost like, how did it go? It was a Wiley. And I think you must have created that goddess, because it's almost now
because I did it more than
Royal Air Force term.
Right, boys, here you go. I'm going to ask you a little bit of a geeky question. It is a geeky question. I make no apologies for this whatsoever. I'm going to ask it, and then you guys are just going to go for it, all right? What is the definitive version of a Spitfire? Is it the one which was most successful in combat, or is it the ultimate technological version of this, like one of the Seafires? In your mind, what is that ultimate version?
Who's going first?
Well, I'm looking at Dunk smiling. So, Dunk, what do you think?
I seem to get to answer first for the majority of the time tonight. Lucky me. I think the early ones are just beautiful. However, for me, it's the beauty of the aeroplane that's really striking. It's fantastic to fly. It's got the legendary background. But out of all the aeroplanes, you know, my favorite, just of the ones that we flew, was the Mark V, because it, you know, it's beautiful. Actually, the Mark IX, I think, has got the lines, the nose is just slightly longer, and I think it's the perfect aeroplane to look at. So for me, it would be the Mark IX.
Go on, Goddard.
Well, I was going to say, it's the Mark V for me, although if you speak to, I mean, Parky, have a chat, you know, you guys have spoken a lot to, you know, people like Jeffrey Wellham and other Second World War guys, but it was the Mark V for me, because the first Spitfire I flew was the Mark IX. And I think it might have been the specific airframe at BBMF, but didn't feel like I thought a Spitfire would feel like, which is actually not how all the Second World War pilots say. You know, they say it was an amazing aeroplane, you know, just the right sort of balance on it. But actually, then when I got in the Mark V for the first time, and there is a story there, which we can tell at a later date, didn't quite keep her on the runway, but was about the most beautiful flying machine I'd ever flown. After that particular incident, I almost had an emotional connection to this particular one, which sounds kind of strange, you know, because I immediately wanted to go and fire again. I didn't get to for a couple of weeks. It was something that I'd seen Smithy do, and I ended up, you know, giving her a kiss on the side of the on the aeroplane before I'd get in and start flying. And so I think it was that emotional side that you know, made it a fantastic aeroplane. So, although the Mark 19s, I cannot imagine what it had been like to have been a sort of 18, 19, 20-year-old in the Second World War and to get into, Dunk mentioned, a Mark 19 with a 37-litre Griffin engine, because the power on those things are unbelievable. I mean, they held the world altitude record for a prop aeroplane until, when was it? God, I think it's 1950.
Is that right?
No, I think it still does.
Oh, well, there you go.
A quick one, Goddard. What did you expect it to feel like? Because you said it wasn't as you expected. What were you hoping for?
Well, so I think a lot of us are quite careful not to be Spitfire snobs, because the first aeroplane you fly on, first Warbird you fly on BBMF, after you've got a, you fly the Chipmunk first, then you fly the Harvard, then you go and have you know, your Hurricane Ground School. I think I mentioned that in episode one. And you fly the Hurricane, and the Hurricane, I think, flies like she looks, you know, very solid, very stable, reliable. And you get used to that. You've done a fair few hours in the Hurricane before you then graduate, if you like, to the Spitfire. And right away, to be much more agile than that Hurricane. But there was something about that Mark 9. She's quite a heavy, almost docile aeroplane, especially when you fly the lighter weight, the Mark 5 or the Mark 2, that, I mean, don't get me wrong, it was just amazing. She was painted silver at the time. And I remember taking off, standard feeling, oh my God, I've got a lander again. But looking out the window, doing that general handling and seeing that classic elliptical wing out of what is a really fantastic view. In a Hurricane, it's like you're sat in a greenhouse. In a Spitfire, it's almost the aeroplane is strapped to you, and you know, you can see everything. It is your classic single seat bubble canopy aeroplane. So that part of it was amazing, but she didn't feel a huge amount different to the Hurricane.
Yeah, it was weird, Goddess. That the Mark 9 that BBMF have, MK356, she just never rolled really well, and she just wasn't very fast. It's odd. She's got an identical engine to the Mark 16, but If you owned her, you would, I know, at the end of the day, be disappointed. She just, you know, I'd never say it to her face. She looks gorgeous, but she was just a slow aircraft. And compared to all the other Spits, you know, I love the Mark II because it flew in the Battle of Britain. But I fly a Civvy Mark IX now at Aero Legends, and it is everything that, you know, Eric Winkle Brown rated the Mark IX probably as his favourite Spit, and he flew them all. And a lot of the boys in the war, they sort of, I've heard him talking to the 9 and the 16. But I think when I flew the Aero Legends Mark 9, it was everything a Mark 9 should be. It was so much faster than the dear old BBMF one. And, you know, when she was getting ripped apart for the Major, we all thought we would find a dead camel or something in the back of it, you know, because to explain why it was so slow. But I know what you mean. I flew our Mark 9 for the first time, and it wasn't the quantum leap. And then I flew the 2 that afternoon, and that's what I thought the Spitfire would be.
That's because Smithy let you fly the two because you didn't crash the nine like I did. No, it was the other way around.
No, I flew that Mark 9 as well, the Aero Legends Mark 9. And as Parky said, you know, the difference was just phenomenal. The poor old Mark 9 on BBMF, we did everything we could to try and fix her. But we people have spent years, decades almost, trying to get her where she should be, because everyone's aware she doesn't quite fly how she should do.
So why?
Say again.
Why?
It's a really interesting point, JB, because it just shows that every single one of those aeroplanes, even the two Mark 19s, all flew differently. They all genuinely, it feels a bit cliched to say it, but had their own personality. You'd end up speaking to them and you know, like I say, give them a kiss on the side before you get in and a pat on the side, you know, just to look after you. But you knew how each one of them flew in the end. I remember, you know, that very first time that I flew the Mark 5, Parky had said to me, watch her on landing, she likes to go right. Sure enough, she went right quite spectacularly when I did fly it.
For no particular reason. I guess they are all hand-built. I mean, that's the thing. They'll all have their own certain quirks.
Yeah, we had such a... you know, in my time, and well, Parky was there as well on BBMF, we kept thinking, we found it, you know, and the engineers, we go, right, you know, we'll look into it. We got the aeroplane laser measured, and they found that the starboard wing was sat, well, initially they thought the fuselage was bent, but they found actually that the starboard wing had been mounted incorrectly, and it sat about 3 inches lower than the port wing.
Really?
And so they got people in, they reamed out the where the mountings are and put it right, and we were like, great. So I went off to test fly, no, the same. We found that, you know, so we found that the it was the engineers, and they said, oh, we've you know, the bell cranks on the ailerons, we found out that the mod is the wrong mod, and actually they've got a 3/4 restriction on them, so we're going to take the restriction out. We're like, great, we found it. And no, just the same. Everything we did, you know, we kept thinking we found something, and but nothing fixed her.
Amazing. Absolutely. I mean, the idea of the wings being at slightly different heights is quite incredible, actually.
Well, there was a story. Dunk flies the Tucano as well at the moment. And there was a story when they first got introduced into service, because I was one of the last courses going through on the Jet Provost. And down at I was at Linton-on-Ouse. Down at Cranwell, they'd taken delivery of the Tucano. And so the story goes, and I think it's true, that they rolled the first 10 out and they're taking a photo of them. And the photographer goes, hey, that one over there, it's sticking a bit too far forward. Can you move it back? So the guys move it back. And then takes the photo, moves to the back and goes, hang on, that one over there, it's sticking a bit too far out the back. Can you move it forward? And it turned out that the second one in was about a foot longer than the other ones.
How?
Which, if it isn't true, it's a great story anyway. But, you know, I think it was all... It's essentially when you get hand-built aeroplanes.
Yeah, well, didn't they have the problem with this exact problem with the Nimrods when they tried to upgrade them? Which is why it cost billions and billions of pounds more, because every one of them was hand-built. So you couldn't actually upgrade them all.
No, it was exactly that. There weren't any rigs available, and you know, as soon as they took the wings off and tried to put new stuff on, it was damn near impossible. Every single one was bespoke in the first place. So I mean, it was one of the reasons in terms of Nimrod, which is a very emotional subject for a lot of people that we could get into in another podcast. But it is all about hand-built aeroplanes, and when you think of all of that aircraft production. You know, we joke about it being in front rooms, but the shadow factories and everything that were built in the Second World War, I mean, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people just working away and pumping these things out. One of the great books to read about exactly that is Cipher Merlin by Alex Henshaw, which is just an amazing book. A civilian guy who test flew something like, boys, correct me, 2,300 Spitfires in the Second World War.
Wow.
And there's YouTube footage of him as well doing his famous displays, which involved all sorts of stuff that we wouldn't go anywhere near, including inverted push-ups that made the engine stopped and starting the engine again as he pulled through on the bottom half of a loop at about 3 feet. I mean, just an amazing guy, and the book just well worth a read.
Now, that's probably quite a nice little segue, actually. I would quite like to get to know a little bit about display flying, and what I mean by that is, where have you displayed, and what are the more interesting displays that you've done, whether it be with the Battle of Britain stuff, or you know, in a Typhoon, or whatever it may be.
Yeah, shall I go? I mean, I got the Tornado F3 display back in the day in 99 and 2000. And it's a weird thing, JB. You know, I just wanted to be a fighter pilot, you know, doing ops, etc. And display flying is something completely different. You do practice, you know, aerobatic flying, but, you know, at height, you know, we use a base height of 5,000 feet in the military. So it's very safe and you're up pretty high flying it. And suddenly when you get chosen to display the jet, you know, fairly quickly, you're down at 100 feet and you can fly upside down at 500 feet. And it genuinely is. It's one of those. It's almost hard to believe that this is, you know, legal, the flying that you are doing. And it actually becomes normal quite quickly. But, you know, I just never really forgot that feeling of this is unbelievable fun. It is absolutely, I think, the most wonderful thing to do, you know, low-level aerobatics. Exhilarating, you know, adrenaline pumping. And, you need to fly well to, you know, to do a good show, and the Red Arrows was identical to that, but multiply that, and obviously the formation element in a Spitfire, you know, or Hurricane, it's maybe more the grace of the aircraft, etc. But you are definitely maneuvering low to the ground, you know, and really max performing or flying aggressively but safely, and there's big shows, there's big venues, so the whole thing of display flying, it really, to me, was a quantum leap and just mega exciting, an absolutely wonderful world to get into.
How did you go about...
Did you guys... yeah, I was just going to ask the question, because when you start in BBMF, in the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, you fly singleton displays. So, you know, you're out there on your own. And then very soon you get into formation displays. You join up with the Lancaster. You know, really exciting. And when you're in formation... you're concentrating on being in formation so much that you don't really get to have a look at the surroundings. And one, you know, I really enjoy doing air show, doing displays at big air shows, especially when it was your display. So you go away and do the Hurricane display or the Spitfire display, because you're concentrating on your display, but you could look out the window. You could see what was going on. You see the crowd line, you see the huge crowds that you get at some of these places, you know, so upwards of 100,000 people at Fairford, and down on the coast, you know, Bournemouth, there can be up to 500,000 people, half a million people out on the beaches over a couple of weekends. But I guess for you guys who've done the Red Arrows, I guess you were concentrating on formation flying most of the time. Were you just completely focused on that, or did you get a chance to look out the window?
I think the the Reds, when you start, so certainly your first year, potentially your second, but when you get into your third year, you enter the part of the team called Gippo, which is the back four, you do in the second half anyway, certainly some more dynamic stuff, which involves you flying on your own and then rejoining with other aircraft, or flying relatively close to another aircraft but doing close passes from left to right. So you then get that exhilaration. And on some of the big splits where you do the vertical brakes, for instance, which you do a loop and then everyone splits and then you all effectively finish the loop, but finishing at 100 feet. Again, you're just on your own then, and you're judging your pullout from that maneuver. And again, it's as Parky describes, that bit's very exhilarating, followed by the fact that a high-speed join when you've got 7 or 9 aircraft heading towards each other, you know, and you've got to get that join right, then you know, that's very exhilarating and concentrates the mind as well. So there's plenty there that takes away from just the fact that you're sat there in formation with another 8 aircraft around you.
I think you're always aware of the venue. You know, if it's a big crowd, even in the Reds, you just almost a sixth sense. You know that, as Goddard says, at Riyadh, there's maybe 100,000 people. The difficult one, of if there's any ex-Reds, because you know they're going to nib, and if your smokes are bad or your formation's poor, whatever, you're just aware. You're absolutely, I think all of us trying to seek perfection and do the best job you can at it. But, you know, there's some breathtaking venues and, you know, all, you know, I just see as.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Dunk was talking about some of the red stuff, and you just get snapshots in your memory of, you know, of eight other red aircraft looping and rolling, and the second half maneuvers, as Dunk says. You know, it's absolutely a fabulous world, display flying, and I would, you know, I absolutely recommend it to all the youngsters if they can get into it. You know, it's a lot of the guys haven't even thought about it. It's strange. You know, it's, you know, the Royal Air Force, it's just a tiny little niche thing that we do, you know, to show the aircraft in front of the public. But, yeah, a great thing. And we're so lucky to have done it, the three of us. We really are.
I tell you the one that looks really cool. Is it the Solent where the Reds fairly famously fly through?
Which one's that, Jay?
Down the Solent.
Oh, so Isle of Wight?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
could be Dartmouth. Dartmouth was one of my favourite display locations. I think it's changed post the Shoreham accident. But, you know, I remember, okay, Dartmouth on the Battle of Britain flight, you start a three-ship display, so Lank, Hurricane and Spitfire.
Where was it, Goddard?
As a three-ship. You not hear me say Dartmouth?
Dartmouth. Gotcha.
Go on, Goddard. Don't let them put you off, mate.
Don't let them put you off again.
It had better be a good story.
Couldn't you hear that?
We could hear you, mate. Carry on.
I'll talk about that one later. Someone else go.
No, you're on now. It's no good being all coy. Just get on with it.
Don't. He's going to whisper again.
All right. So one of my favourite places to display was Dartmouth. Only did it a couple of times because when you arrived in formation with the Lancaster, coming down that river, it was like you were on the dams raid because it's such a narrow V-shaped valley. And you guys must have displayed in there in the Reds as well. But doing the half horizontal eight, so, you know, the half loop in the Spitfire back into that valley is just one of the most amazing display venues that I've been to and displayed at. And I remember this one display, Parky mentioned it, certain things flash through your mind or stand out on your memory. And this particular day, flying that Mark V Spitfire that I said was definitely my favourite, and just being amazed at the scenery, the people down at the, you know, it was a ship festival down there in the harbour. It was just amazing. And
a ship festival?
Definitely. That was a good one.
Do you remember, Dunk, when we displayed, this is Red Arrows, displayed at the Burj Al Arab in Dubai?
Yeah, yeah. This
massive, massive hotel that's sort of on the seafront. And I just remember, you know, we were all up for this show, and it gets etched in my mind, beautiful day as it would be. But, you know, just the smoke was sort of lingering in the sky as we were doing this display. But you just, even though you're obviously concentrating at all the aircraft around you and your formation position, you were just in your peripheral get as the boss at the time, Spike, did the display. And it was just lovely and just sort of relatively close. But, you know, it would have looked fabulous from the ground. But you were aware of this massive hotel kept coming into your sort of peripheral vision as you were sort of flying past it. And it was just a breathtaking view. When we were doing the solo stuff afterwards, they were building, it looks like a palm tree in the seafront there. So, and again, just some of the footage, you know, it was, I've got to stop looking out the window here. I've really got to concentrate because it was just breathtaking.
What were you flying?
Did you ever stop looking out the window?
Yeah.
Come on, Parker.
You noticed.
What were you flying, Parky?
You've done an 11 a reef on me there. So I talk about Dartmouth and you're straight in with Dubai. Well, I displayed on the moon once. It was fantastic.
Here, Parky, what were you flying at that time?
So that was the Red Arrows. So in the Little Hawks, we'd done we did a tour out to Langkawi, you know, out to the Far East.
Yeah.
Why are they?
It was brilliant. Back, God, is this pulling faces now? But it was sort of back through India, and we did Egypt, the pyramids. I remember, and it was just, you know, it was brilliant. Some big, big venues, and it's fabulous. You know.
And why are the
RAF? I circumnavigated the sun in a hurricane.
Why are the RAF sending the Red Arrows to Egypt and Dubai and India or wherever? What's the logic behind that?
Well, you know, it's
as far as they could send Parky without hearing him.
Yeah, they sent me on my own. I don't know why. No, it was there's a big air show in Langkawi, which is every other year. So, you know, sales push, Great Britain PLC, you know, we fly the flag and, you know, hopefully, you know, do a good job in terms of, selling the country around the world. You know, the Reds, it was one of the strange things that whenever you meet people. And I think as a country, you know, I'm guilty of it. You know, I tend to think that we're going to lose on penalties in the World Cup and the train's probably going to be late. But for whatever reason... for whatever reason, it seems that you'd meet people and they go, Red Arrows, they're the best in the world and we're really proud of you boys. And you had this outrageous legacy that you had to live up to. And you really were... I mentioned earlier when, you know, there were old boys from the Reds watching you. You really felt the pressure because, you know, their legacy that they gave you was always perfect shows.
Wow.
And, you know, you just didn't want to let the team down. And it was it's a lovely, you know, accolade that the country really does get behind you. And I think we should be very proud of the Reds, you know, when they go abroad and do their bits. You know, I think, you know, we're biased, obviously, but my honest opinion is that show is the best in the world.
Excellent. I tell you what, just with what you've said there, flying at an air show, particularly if you've got other teams there, like, I don't know, the US Navy, are they the Blue Angels, something like that? That must be a different level of pressure being judged by other aviators.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we did, a few big shows, and I remember one we were with the Patrie de France, so the French display team, the Swiss display team were pretty good with their F5s. And the Italian, the Frecce Tricolore. So, and we were in the same hotel and, you know, we were, you know, just bantering and, yeah. And,
I was going to say, massive fight. And we was it like the different news teams on Anchorman?
Yeah.
You
were aware that the next day we'd all be watching each other's display. And, you trust me, you didn't want to mess up. It would have been brutal banter. Getting a smoke wrong and you've got coloured smoke, if you get those wrong, you can easily mess up the display for everyone. So, it was great, you know, meeting all the other teams, very similar ethos, etc. And, and love watching them. But like I said before, I definitely, I rate
right.
the Red Arrows.
Okay. All of you have got to stop because you need to answer this now. I want you to name and shame. What is the worst display you've seen and by who?
Oh,
I've got one. I can go straight in. So Fairford, I think it was 1992, I was training on the Hawk, and I jumped in the back seat with an instructor to go down, and it was to put the Hawk out as a static display. Obviously, if you've been to an air show, you can see there's lots of airplanes on display that the public can walk around. And then you've got the display side where people fly. And it was not long after the Berlin Wall had come down. And it was the very first time that MiG-29s had displayed in the UK.
Wow.
So in that afternoon, everyone has turned up to watch this display. And they were flying a two-ship display. I can remember, you'll see why in a second, but I remember it absolutely, completely clearly, because they started, and it is a hugely powerful aeroplane. Back in 92, you know, we were flying Tornadoes, Jaguars. We didn't have anything that could take off and go straight up. These guys did that. They flew some amazing formation right up until the point they hit each other. And there was this massive, massive fireball. I mean, it was horrendous at the time, because it's your worst nightmare, obviously, at a display. But we only saw one chute anyway. So utter carnage. Having flown in and seen how many people were in and around the airfield, I just assumed that loss of life was huge. But actually, they'd landed right in the middle of the airfield. No one had been injured. In fact, the only person who was injured was one of the pilots. Because if you watch the video, one sparks up a cigarette and the other one comes over and punches him in the face.
And me and Dunk often end our sorties as well.
Is that true?
That's why Parky looks like he does. I genuinely punch him in the face at the end of most sorties.
Sorry, I just want to drill down on that. That isn't true. The one pilot doesn't punch the other one in the face, surely.
Well, that's what I heard from a bloke down the pub. Apparently it's on YouTube. I'm going to look it up.
I will do. I love that idea.
But it goes on. The most admiration I've had, I think, for anyone in flying since I've been flying, was between the Swiss who were flying F5s, painted bright red, and this crash had essentially happened over the top of them, and it was only about a 10-minute delay. Then the Swiss took off. They were clear to take off and continue their display. And you can see people diving out the way whenever they were doing their opposition maneuvers. But, I mean, utter balls of steel there to have witnessed that and go off and do that display flying. Just a completely surreal day, and definitely one that I will remember forever.
Wow, that's going to take some beating. Anyone fancy beating it?
Do you know, that is a good story. I didn't realise you were there. I've seen, you know, video of that, and it is just, you know, that's a unforgettable moment that you saw. But the ones I used to feel sorry sometimes for, you know, the little light aircraft, maybe singletons that are flying, and the organisers might put them behind a Raptor or something like that. So an F-22 literally defies aviation and does the most breathtaking show, and then some poor little mate's got to get airborne in some propelled aircraft, and you just feel for him. You know, even if he probably flew it beautifully, you know, by definition of what he's flying. But, you know, air shows are great, and, you know, I think we have overdosed on air shows in the last, probably, I don't know, me and Dan, kind of 15-odd years, but I still, you know, you can't help but watch and have a good look, and we're absolutely ridiculously critical and you know, anal about what we do, especially with the display flying. But, you know, it's great. It's a great day out, and, you know, and I'm probably banging on about it. It's a lovely world to be in.
Yeah. And you haven't named or shamed anyone.
Right, Dunk.
I'm not going to. I'm going to leave it to Dunk.
Dunk. Okay, so my one actually is pretty recent. So Goddard has gone back in time so as not to embarrass anyone, because the poor Russian boys have probably been, you know, shipped off to Siberia, haven't they? So you'll never see them again.
The Kremlin wants a word.
They don't get podcasts in Siberia, although maybe that's what they make them listen to. You'll have to listen to this podcast.
they listen to your solo podcast, Douglas.
But the so for me, I went to Fairford last year, but I got invited to go there very kindly as a guest of someone. So I thought, that's great. Do you know what? It's been a long time since I've just been able to sit down and watch an air show, because normally you're involved in them. So and the reason that I was excited about it was because they had the F-22 there. So it pitched up, and the F-22 arrived on the runway. And God bless our American brethren. The commentator, they're far more. I mean, we're like our caricatures, really. So we're typically British and staid mostly, and it's all very well commentated on like this. But the Americans, of course, they were like, "Okay, here is the F-22 Raptor," and this was just him lining up, and so he lined up, and it's like, right, this is going to be a fantastic display. The cloud base is 1,400 feet, ladies and gentlemen. He is revving up his engine, so he's going on and on about the Raptor. At the moment, the Mustang, the World War II fighter, it is going to check the cloud base for the F-22, which will, in a moment, put on the most miraculous display, ladies and gentlemen. And so it carried on like this, and so it literally went, oh, and the Mustang is radioing in now, and ladies and gentlemen, it's cancelled, he's taxiing. And that was it. So that was it. I sat over and was like, well, I'll go and have a cup of tea then.
Why did they cancel it? Why did they cancel it, Dunk?
Well, apparently 1,500 feet was his limit, and the cloud was at 1,400 feet. So I was like, right, we're not going.
Have you ever thought about becoming a commentator, Dunk?
Yes, yeah, I think that was
excellent.
For the WWE?
Well, it's funny. So we had, when I was on the squadron in the States, the F-16 demo, as it was called, was flown from Shaw Air Force Base, where I was. And they asked for volunteers, for guys to go and do the commentary. And we had one of the quietest guys I've ever met volunteer. He got the job, but he was a maniac on the microphone. It was amazing. And it is it is part of their show. When you see the Thunderbirds, for example, their show starts as they walk out to the aeroplane.
Really?
You know, there's a ton of stuff on the ground. It's almost formation walking. They'll do a you
know, I think that's called sort of marching, Godders.
Formation.
I think you'll find
in Air Force. Do you remember that walking in the military?
I can't believe you know that when you've left.
Is that how for this year for REF 100? Is that what you've been? So Commodore Godfrey. What do you think we should do? Well, I think we should have some of that. That formation walking stuff. We should have some of that, shouldn't we?
No, but you don't do tricks when you're or high five when you're marching. That's my get out clause.
Oh dear!
I was just getting to the high five bit, and then they got the ladders together. I guess there's a term for that, Parky.
Yeah, we used to have a display startup and shutdown, didn't we, Dunk?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
And you sort of ripple the canopies of the Hawk and make it. I remember we were meant to do one at Cranwell for the 40th. So the boss would brief, is going to be a display shutdown, and you know you wait for the boss. And literally, I just forgot. So all the other eight Hawks were there, and I just shut down over my canopy and got out. And it was like, oh, dear. All the other eight boys were doing little signs to me.
I can't tell you how delighted I was to see that.
Ruined it.
Did you get fined?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What was the fine system?
Well, it was just, I think it was kind of like if you were a second late with your smokes or if you were late for transport, the executive officer, which was one of the pilots in his third year, had the power. And it was just, you know, you got fined and we all put it towards a beer at the end of the day sort of thing. But, you know, you would try and avoid fines and it got ridiculously competitive. I think you could declare a clear round before the debrief. So you're literally saying, I have made no mistakes. And then if you manage to get it without any mistakes, So you had all your fines of that week scrubbed, and it was all it all got ridiculously.
Also, it was a double of quits.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Big time.
And then it was good to call that. It was a ballsy move, and you know, because you had to be pretty confident that you'd done pretty well. And so, of course, everyone was sort of gunning for you a little bit. And so the tape would be stopped and rewound for ever just to make sure that you were bang on with your smokes. But I think it was Parky. I think it was just 10p for a smoke error, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I think it was if you were in your second year was 20p, third year 30, fourth year 40. Because I came back and I remember for that fourth year, and I can remember the first thing JG, who is now the exec. And I had been the exec the previous year and left. So it was this, the first thing he said to me, 40p fines for you. I was like, oh, God.
This is.
He was a lovely
fella.
Can
I just say, boys, this is unbelievably trivial. When he said fines, I was like, oh, right, yeah, 100 quid, maybe a night in jail, you know, military sort of stuff. Oh, no, 10 pence, 20 pence, or 30 pence, depending on your seniority.
But the thing is, you could easily have 10 fines a trip, and you were flying three times a day on the workup.
That's a pound, JB. That's a flipping pound.
JB, you have to remember, when these boys were in the Reds, that is now worth about 600 quid.
It's just slightly less than a shilling.
We weren't paid much then.
That's absolutely excellent. Boys, let's leave that on a high note.
A 30p high note formation walking.
Formation walking. Fantastic. Godders, where is our Twitter? What's it called?
We are Pilot Episodes Pod on Twitter. And actually, if we've got a couple of minutes, there are a couple of questions that have come through that
awesome.
I'd ask people to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So who have we got here? We've got Stan Egerton, who says, why does a modern jet need so much manpower to service after a flight compared to the length of the flight? Surely the mechanical stuff is relatively simple and electronics would log a problem. Well, that's actually the case. It only needs a couple of people to service an aeroplane. And definitely in Typhoon, you fly it a few times a day, but you will download a little electronic brick, plug it into the computer, and the Typhoon tells the engineers, the maintainers, if there is something up with it. Obviously, a pilot will debrief, so if there's a snag with the aeroplane, you'll get out and tell them so they know already. But it's essentially as easy as that. So in answer to Stan's question, it's probably not changed since the Second World War in terms of a couple of people to rearm it, refuel it, and have a look around, as long as there's nothing seriously wrong.
Awesome. Have we got any more?
So I'll pass this one to Parky, actually. So this is from clearly a relative of mine, Chris Godfrey at Foodie Sales. Is flying the aircraft secondary in modern jets to the mission, i.e. is the plane so easy to fly the mission is more labour intensive?
Yeah, I think, you know, Typhoon is, it's a lovely, delightful aircraft to fly, and it's not difficult. You know, even I could do it. It's just operating all the systems. You know, you just get swamped by information, and there's times where there's smoke coming out your ears when you're working so hard, and it's really cherry picking what's important, what you should be doing at that time, because there's often too much. And I think that is the key to it. You know, they build devices out of the aircraft, so they are easy to fly. You know, and technically it should make it easier, but. Yeah, you look at your tape at times. I used to love, you know, listening, and I probably, you know, listened to one of your tapes, Godders, and you would almost be yelling at the jet yourself on your own, because, you know, you're just working at times, and it's got a voice, so it speaks to you. The aircraft talks to you, and you'd often be answering it back in no uncertain terms. But yeah, it can get busy, but yeah, the aircraft are easier to fly without a doubt.
Can I just...
And that's continued on with F-35. I was up in the BA Systems, actually, up at Wharton. I've got an F-35 sim, which is actually for landing on the boat. The simulator is for the landing signals officer and the pilot. And it's a really accurate sim with a rolling deck, and you can put in big waves and everything. And the F-35 is so easy compared to a Harrier coming up alongside... pull over and land on the deck. You essentially press a button, you push the stick forward to go down, you pull the stick backwards to go up, and the throttle pushes you forward and aft. It was the easiest thing I've ever done, which is not how it was in the Harrier. So things are easy, just so you can operate the aeroplane and get on with the fighting the aeroplane.
Can I just follow that up with a sort of secondary question to that? And feel free to chip in, but I'll aim at a Dunk first because he's been a little bit quiet, a little bit left out. Do you reckon that there was... Is there a period where peak pilot was needed? So what I mean by that is, you know, as you've gone from prop-driven aircraft over to jets, everything's getting faster, but there's not necessarily as much aid as there is nowadays. When was the hardest time to fly, would you say?
I think probably 60s and 70s, I would imagine, you know, because the performance of the aeroplanes, you know, when we were down at the Royal Air Force Museum and we all were sort of gawking at the Lightning, and those guys, you know, they had to operate their radar. They had like a diver's mask. They had to put their head in whilst they're traveling, you know, supersonic speeds. They've got a jet which is really quite difficult to handle. And they've got weapons they're trying to employ that were not, the standoff range of them was not nearly as much as they are today. So they're closer, things are happening quicker. They're trying to get these things to lock on. So I would imagine the combination of workload with the weapons that were advancing at a rate of knots and were becoming really quite complex. But we hadn't got the kind of systems that we've got now that allow the pilots and the operators of the aircraft to integrate with them seamlessly. I would imagine that was probably the most difficult time.
Awesome. Do we have any more there, Godders?
There is one that is quite niche.
Love it.
So Parky won't get this, but he knows exactly who it's from. It's from our old mate, David Thomas, at David Thomas 338, DT, who has tweeted, BSIP versus RSIP, target 2, Whole Beach, discuss.
Right, well, explain this. Come on.
So as an ex Harrier qualified weapons instructor, I'm going to ask Dunk to explain it. No, so
it's probably worth ending there, JB.
It was two different modes of bombing in a Harrier. It was continuously computed impact points. So if you ever see the head-up display video of someone bombing, you'll see a line down from a little aircraft symbol, and you'll see a cross on the ground that moves around. So that gave you a continuously computed point that when you push the button, that is where the bomb was going to drop. Whole Beach was one of our training ranges. Target 2 was a target that we knew and loved and used the whole time. And B in SIP was Barrow, and R was Redoubt. And so you either had a barometric solution where the aeroplane used the pressure of the day to work out its height solution, or you used the Redoubt, which pinged off the ground. So my answer to that question, and Dunk's going to agree with here, who are both doing, they're shooting themselves in the face, is for DT, RSIP, target 2, always.
God, that's a belter of a question, isn't it?
Always good to end on a high note.
I liked it. Personally, I liked it.
I think that was probably the high point of the podcast.
Right, well...
Oh, yeah, me too.
Do you know what? I absolutely love the question. So if you are listening and you do want to leave a question, please get in contact at the Twitter handle, which Godders will just inform us of again.
It's... Pilot Episode Pod.
There you go. Send in your questions, retweet, spread the word, all the rest of it. And the more you do that, the more of these pods that we'll do. Isn't that right, gentlemen?
Yep,
absolutely.
Yeah, excellent. Right, let's leave it there. Shall we try and get together again in about 2 weeks or maybe a week's time?
Sounds great.
Yeah, sure.
Perfect.
Superb.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.